Welcome to the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast, where business leaders tell their stories and share their insights. All of our guests have a personal connection with Nottingham Business School, so listen, learn, enjoy and share.
Welcome to this episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast with me, Mike Sassy. Peter Cheese is one of Britain's most influential voices on the future of work. He has been chief executive of the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development since 2012. During his 14 years at the helm, he has helped turn the CIPD into a globally recognised authority on people, skills and workplace performance, supporting more than 160,000 members worldwide. Peter was formerly a global MD at HR consultancy Accenture. For decades, he has worked at the intersection of business strategy, technology and people. His 2021 book, The World of Work, anticipated many of the challenges leaders now face, including the intricacies of AI disruption and shifting global labour markets. Today, he joins us to give us his insights into what responsible leadership looks like in 2026. Peter Cheese, welcome to this episode of the NBS Business Leaders Podcast.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you for the kind introduction.
Great stuff. So you recently gave a lecture, as we were just discussing off camera, here at the Nottingham Business School about the future of work, very well received. How do the conversations that you have with leaders and future leaders at places like Nottingham shape your thinking about leadership challenges?
They're really important because I think in an uncertain world, which we live in now, the more that we can connect and reach out and learn from each other and collaborate, the better. And I love events like the event at Nottingham Business School, where it was a good mix of academics, HR practitioners, business leaders, and so on. And I really do believe, as we look at the opportunities, but also the challenges ahead of us, so the more that we collaborate and bring together different thinking and different insights, that's good for all of us. And it's good for us, whether we're leaders or whether we're trying to shape organizations for the future.
You're stepping down from CIPD later this year after 14 years as the CEO. So what feels fundamentally different about leadership in 2026 compared to when you started in 2012?
I think there's a number of things. I mean, just echoing that sort of theme of uncertainty. I mean, I think now are in times of greater uncertainty than any of us can remember. And I know I used in the talk and often do use that sort of simple framework of pestles, of political, economic, social, technological, legal, and environmental change. And as I've said for a while now, that you can look at every one of those dimensions, and there are very significant things that are happening. You know, obviously, I don't have to spell out some of the geopolitical things, but also political change within countries and different political attitudes and views of the world, economic uncertainty, and that creates all sorts of different pressures in organizations, and indeed individuals, of course. Social change. You know, we debate a lot about different generational attitudes, but also recognizing our demographics of many countries in the West, if you will, have aging populations. It's impacting our workforces and questions like how long will we all be working for? technology with all of the AI stuff, which I know we'll talk a bit more about. Legal. We are going through at the moment the implementation of the biggest changes in employment legislation for a generation in the UK. And those aren't my words, those are the words of the government. So that's a lot to absorb. And even things like environmental, we all have a responsibility in, I think, every function, and certainly as business leaders, to be clear on what is our impact and how we support this debate and practices around environmental protection.
So before we start and unpick all that, let's just have one bit of self-indulgence. If you were to look back on your 14 years with CIPD, are there two or three decisions that you're most proud of and things like, and what did you learn from them?
Yeah, my instinct has always been is to reach out and to collaborate. You know, but the things we're dealing with do require, as I said, lots of shared thinking, and you know, some people talk about wicked problems, and wicked problems can only be solved by bringing lots of perspectives. So my approach to life has always been that, and I'm very proud of many of the connections that we've made with the CIPD, including with Nottingham Business School. So I look at it all the way from academic research, because that builds evidence of what we should be taking into practice, all the way through to policymakers and regulators. And I think we've greatly increased our voice and presence in that world. So working directly with the government on many of the changes, not just the Employment Rights Act, but all of the programs around what they call Get Britain Working and so on. Obviously through the profession and through to business leaders as well. And just to echo a thought in terms of leadership, what I've also seen, you know, partly given all the contextual things I rattled through, is that business leaders are absolutely embracing much more that central to their thinking has to be understanding of organization, people and culture. And that wasn't always true. And recognizing the key strategic pillar of any business strategy has to be how we understand those dimensions of our business. And I think all of this also has brought about a little bit more, dare I say, humility in all of us that can't have all of the answers, and therefore one of the most important skill sets, which has been talked about for a while, but I think we're really seeing more evidence of it now, is the ability to listen and to learn. And hence I am proud of the way in which I think the organization operates and to those values as well, and helps to move forward these very significant agendas in terms of the research and the evidence and the practical support for the profession and through into business as well.
Okay, so back in 2021, when you published your book, The New World of Work, you famously emphasized the importance of good work, which was defined in terms mm-hmm. of engagement, meaning, fairness, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. How has that definition changed over the last 5 years? And has it changed mm-hmm. in an era of shaped by AI?
Yeah, I think what's interesting is that the principles of good work are in many ways not rocket science, to use an analogy. And we've known about many of these dimensions for a long time. So as you said, Michael, I mean, work that I understand its purpose and meaning. And we've been talking about that for quite a long time, particularly interestingly, as the younger generations, millennials, now Gen Z or Gen Z came into work, they're very focused on those sorts of ideas. And frankly, we always should have been, but we weren't quite so much as we are now. So having purpose and meaning, what I do that aligns what my job is to the organizational outcomes is obviously a dimension. But things like fairness, I'm treated fairly, I'm in a supportive culture, I'm paid fairly, that it's also therefore good for my well-being as an outcome. And I think that's absolutely vital. But it's also a role in which I can grow. I have empowerment and space to do that. And I can see that the organization is investing in me in some way. So those are all attributes that we've arguably known about for a long time. But we brought them together into a framework of good work. We did work with Warwick Business School on that and quite a number of years ago. And we've used that actually also to drive what we call our good work index, where we go out every year and we ask a lot of people in lots of different sectors, what do you think about your job in relation to those kind of criteria? So we've seen it being picked up in other ways. There are a lot of things like good employment charters that we've seen around the country where particularly regional and combined authorities are picking up the idea of place-based support and then saying, we want to create good working environments for all. And part of the principles of that should be, variously called things like good employment or fair work and so forth. But they are built around the same sorts of principles. And to your point about how AI is impacting that, I actually do believe that, and I talk about this a lot, and I talked about it in my talk a couple of weeks ago, that we should see good work as a North Star. We should see it as an outcome. We should see that we have the opportunity with technology and AI to in many ways change and even transform the kinds of jobs that we do. But in doing that, to be guided by the idea of what a good job really is, because that's good for people, it's good for performance, it's good for outcomes, and ultimately will be good for society, because it also speaks, as I said, to these ideas of things like fairness, which I think are really, really important.
You don't think that that leaders, that business people would rather seize the potential productivity gains of AI rather than mesh them with the ethical responsibilities that they have to put together job quality and trust?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair challenge. I mean, these are, of course, are some of the big questions that we're all asking the old ideas of does capital just displace labor? So I invest in technology, I don't need all the people. And by the way, if I've got a machine doing, I don't have to worry about what I'm paying them or whether I've got a staff canteen or whatever. So I think we have to look at this from a number of perspectives. First of all, using technology in responsible ways to make sure that the jobs that we are doing are good for people. So we're getting the best out of people as well as we're getting the best out of technology. And that takes some quite heavy lifting. And certainly I profoundly believe in the role of our profession, the people profession should play in that. But then more broadly, you can extrapolate that and say, yes, and if part of the outcome of that is greater productivity, then does that mean that we have fewer jobs? And I often quote John Maynard Keynes, the great British economist, who back in the 1930s said he thought that by about now, we'd be working 15-hour weeks, because he said we will find ways to be more productive. What he missed, and this is another big part of the wider debate, is that we've just created more and more work. So it's an extraordinary phenomenon when you look around the modern world of work and think people seem to be working as hard as they ever did. Sometimes harder. We can see stress in the workplace is on an upward trend. And you think, well, whatever we do with this, we should be finding solutions to those problems as well using technology. So I think in the first instance, it's about how do we make sure the jobs we're creating are good jobs, balance out workloads, find the ways in which we can reduce stress, make sure that work should be good for us. So we should be creating as an outcome better well-being as a result of these things. But there are those bigger questions. And are we going to move into a world where we see an increasing sort of bifurcation between those people that might have the skills or the wherewithal to get in work and those that don't? And that is a concern. There are also growing concerns about young people, because a lot of businesses talking about, well, I could get AI to do a lot of the entry-level jobs. And what I need is moving from the construct of a pyramid-shaped organization to more of a diamond-shaped organization. But if we all follow that path, then how do we get the people to the middle of the diamond if we've never given them a chance in the first place? So there are some bigger system-wide discussions that need to be held on that. But within organizations, I think we have to look at the responsibility we have in shaping that future that brings people with us, helps them to upskill and reskill where they need to, is fair in how we are giving opportunities to people and creating, as I said, better outcomes ultimately, therefore, for people, which is good to attract and retain them, but also, of course, the business performance metrics that matter to every business.
Mm. So if we layer on top of that the huge geopolitical instability that is around now, how do business leaders adapt their people strategy in a world that is so fragmented and unpredictable?
As I said, first of all, the people strategy is a core pillar of every business strategy, but it hasn't always been seen as such and often wasn't even present. In the geopolitical world that's been emerging, a lot of my consulting career was in the time of globalization, the 90s, the early noughties, and I was working with organizations all around the world looking at their workforce strategies and saying, you can attract or retain talent from almost anywhere. You could build operations almost anywhere. We were all sort of moving into this world of free movement of goods, labor, and services very largely. And then, for the last while, certainly 15, 20 years, it's felt like the handbrake has been steadily pulled on. And now, of course, we're in a situation where it is not just being pulled on, and it feels like we're going into reverse on a lot of these ideas. Now, the impact on business is significant, because we have built business models in many, many cases where we sort of globalized our supply chains. We've gone to different parts of the world that either have the capability. I mean, Taiwan is always an interesting case in point, where they built that incredible capability to develop the most advanced chips on the planet and therefore were the place to go. Now people are saying, well, but is that secure? Or we've gone to countries like India and China and assume that, of course, they can do the stuff we do and just do it cheaper. And so why wouldn't I outsource some of or supply chains into those sorts of parts of the world? And that's not just about geopolitical change. It's also about recognition that those countries never saw themselves as just the cheap whatever it was we dreamt up in the West. So they naturally are therefore competing. So you've got a number of these forces going on, which do mean that we have to, in many ways, rethink our business models and our supply chains and our access to talent. So the access to talent point is absolutely about workforce strategy or people strategy. And then this phrase of, do I buy, build, borrow, or bot? I don't know if you've heard that, Michael, but it's a sort of fairly simple construct. It just says that when you're looking at capabilities and talent that you need, you can buy it in, you can recruit it, you can build it, you can develop it and upskill. And I think we need to do a lot more to really make learning and development within our organizations a strategic capability. And we can use technology to deliver that in very different ways. So that's the build part. The borrow could be that I contract or I partner or I outsource. And bot is that I can automate. People have added other Bs, incidentally, to that chain of ideas. But nonetheless, you get the point that when we're looking at organizational strategy and people strategy now, we have to think quite broadly, because no business can be absolutely brilliant at everything. So the sort of core competence of being good at partnering and knowing how to do that well, how we, as I said, revisit some of our supply chains. And of course, part of the answer, many organizations are saying, well, if I can't rely on, in quotes, cheaper labor from some other parts of the world, then, and for other reasons, security reasons, whatever, I need to bring it back on shore, then the first thing I'm going to do is look at how much I can automate, because that will help me reduce the cost. So that's another dynamic, which is, of course, you know, changing the world. And then to extend it, that thought a little bit further, when you look at, you know, countries like India, which have, you know, grown massively in their economies by outsourcing businesses from Europe and the United States, what does it mean for them? If those sorts of countries are starting to reshore, as it's sometimes called, or bring back some of the capabilities that they had pushed out through these global supply chains. And that's before I've even talked about some of the ideas that are coming through political leadership, not least in America, that is strongly encouraging businesses to do exactly that.
So now we're going to take a quick break from our chat to mention the MBA programs at Nottingham Business School. As we've learned from many of our guests, effective business leadership is about confidence, adaptability, and thinking strategically. These are the key ingredients to delivering innovation and impact in crowded competitive markets. So if you are ready to transform your career, visit ntu.ac.uk/MBA. to explore the MBA programs at Nottingham Business School. We're one of only 1% of business schools worldwide who hold the prestigious Triple Crown accreditation. That's ntu.ac.uk/MBA to find out more. Now back to the show.
So with all these increased and new complexities, what are the skills and capabilities that will define the most effective leaders going forwards?
Yeah, I mean, these things I think a lot about. I think, first of all, I always say it's the ability for leaders to deal with paradox and uncertainty, because that is the reality. And yet you look at the past and you even look at statements from big business lobbying bodies, and this constant refrain of business needs certainty. And of course it does. I mean, in an ideal world, it'd all be certain. We knew exactly what we were doing. We wouldn't have to worry about risk because it was all figured out. That has never been true. But most importantly, as I've already outlined, that we are in this increasingly uncertain world. And it is extraordinary to think that I think any of us would be hard pushed to say exactly what is it going to look like in the next 2, 3, 4 years, let alone 10, 20, 30 years. Now, for some organizations, they're used to working on shorter time frames. Yeah, you could say arguably retailers, you know, their goods and products and services can change very quickly. They have to be able to follow consumer whims very fast. So they're very agile, tend to think more short-term. You know, they're still investing long-term, things like retail footprint and new models and all the rest of it, but their business is more operationally driven in the short-term. But you take big capital companies investing in vast infrastructure or other things of that nature, where the cycle of how they think about their business strategy may be 10, 20-year cycles. And that's hard. But in either environment, you've got to be able to deal with this idea that I've got to be able to hold competing ideas, which is the idea of dealing with paradox of uncertainty. I've got to figure out my sort of consistency of vision and value and principles, but I've also got to build in agility to my model. So for a long time, we've been talking about business strategy, not as here's my 500-page document that's describing exactly what I'm going to be doing in the next few years. It's arguably more directionally, this is what we stand for, what our principles are, what our values are, what we believe our core competencies are. But our ability to be agile and navigate a fast-changing world, those are the words that I hear all the time. So agility and adaptability. Now, that starts arguably from the top. It says that So leaders have got to be agile and adaptive. And it goes back to the point I made about being a degree of humility, which just says, so I've got to learn from others. I've got to share and collaborate. I've got to be open about what I do know and what I don't know. I've got to build teams around me, which I have the trust in, that they're bringing forth their experiences and ideas, which also speaks to the idea of more inclusive cultures. Because if we only ever surround ourselves with people like us, we know that is not driving innovation and it drives groupthink. And so again, in an uncertain world, we've got to bring these different ideas, create that sort of melting pot of innovation. And that is a real leadership skill and competence to do that, and is born out of this idea that leaders do not know all the answers, which does not mean to say that they flap around in the breeze, not knowing which direction to take. You've still got to set that sense of direction, that sense of vision, that sense of inspiration that, you know, people want to follow you for. And those, I think, have always actually, interestingly, been core characteristics of what make good leaders.
Wow. So what you appear to be saying is that, yes, we need to plan. We need to plan long term. But that plan is just a stencil, really, because it's actually just a set of values, a set of principles, a vision that we might have. It, you know, the detail will be decided as we go along.
To some degree, yes. I mean, obviously, it'll depend a little bit on context. I mean, obviously, we need to know what we are as business, what our unique competences and capabilities are, although even those you sometimes have to look at and say, yeah, but that could be challenged or threatened. Somebody could come in, and particularly with technology, maybe displace that core competence. So we have to think in those ways. But it is being, you know, very clear on those things, which set the sort of framework or stencil, as you described it, for what the organization's about, what we believe and where we're trying to take things. But this idea of being able to be adaptive and agile, recognizing circumstances will change faster than we've ever seen them. I mean, this is a great phrase that, you know, the change has never happened so fast, but it's never going to be this slow again. Now, it's an interesting little wordplay. I think there's truth in it, but there's also truth in the reality that while sort of billions of dollars being poured into things like AI, and it is advancing at an incredible rate of knots, there is always a lag for implementation, the hype reality gap, call it what you will. Businesses can only adapt to some of these things so fast, but it is definitely our ability to be able to react and adapt quicker probably than we've ever done before, and recognize where we will have to alter direction or what we're investing in order to remain competitive and sustainable for the future.
Wow, right. You enthuse about it. You obviously really, really love it, don't you?
No, I do. I mean, I suppose it sort of goes back to what you said at the intro. I've always been fascinated by the confluence of people and technology and business. And that's really what we're talking about here. And having, you know, spent a lot of my life in consulting, I'm not afraid of change. But it's our ability to shape that future. So another quote that I love using, because I think it's so true, is the best way to predict the future is to help to shape it. So we're not without agency. We are not sitting here just subject to what the so-called tech bros decide our future should be, God help us, if you will, much as I admire their innovation, all the rest of it. The reality is it's up to us as business leaders to make sure that we are adopting these technologies in responsible ways and dealing with some of the questions that you described. But at the same time, I think that can be very exciting. I think it'd be really exciting to say that we have agency, we have the ability to shape the future. We're not going to do it on our own as leaders. We're going to do it in collaboration and supporting our people and working with others. But we are, as many have described it, and I described it a bit in my book in 2021, I think in some sort of inflection point, going back to all the points I've already made about the future of work. And let's face it, you know, we cannot sit here and say that the world of work that we've created is all brilliant. You know, I've already stressed points like, the increase of stress in the workplaces. We know that mental health and things of that are not where they need to be, and work is a component part of that. We know that we still have things to work on in terms of fairness and inclusion ideas. We know that we have still apparently many things to work on stuff like productivity and performance. So let's see this as the opportunity. Let's see that we now have, yeah, increasingly within our grasp, some extraordinary new tools that can shape a better future of work. But recognizing that a better future of work is not just about one stakeholder, it's not just about appeasing the financial stakeholder and said, great, we've slashed all our costs, massively increased our profit. Well, who benefits from that? You know, yes, the incumbents of people who might be watching share prices and investing in the company. There's nothing wrong with that. But I've always believed in this sort of multi-stakeholder view for business, which says, yes, the financial, assuming you're a commercial business, your financial stakeholder is important. And if you're a public sector business, obviously the public purse and all of that. But the other stakeholders that we have a responsibility for include our customers, that we're treating responsibly and fairly, our suppliers, which we are treating responsibly and fairly, and we haven't always done that, our employees, which we're treating responsibly and fairly, and of course, are the communities of which we are part, and finally, the environment. And they are all, you know, very much in this construct of what people talk about as the sort of multi-stakeholder view of business. And I think to drive the future business and responsible business, as I see it, we have to pay attention to all those stakeholders. And they are not mutually exclusive. It's not about altruism and saying, well, I just need to do good works all over the place. Although I do incidentally believe in that axiom that you can do well by doing good. And we should see that as a principle. And interestingly, the more that you talk to young people or anybody, frankly, in the world of work today, which is demanding greater transparency of businesses and greater transparency of what leaders think and believe and how they are behaving and a greater sense of accountability. Those are all things that are driving towards those outcomes as well.
You just talked there about young people, and obviously here in Nottingham, we have a lot of early career professionals entering this volatile, changing, AI-driven job market. So finally, what mindsets or habits should matter most to them for their careers and their long-term success?
Yes, yeah, really important. And I spend a lot of time talking to young people. I recognize what they're facing. And in the lots of surveys, I was involved in an OECD piece of research recently was looking about how young people around the world were viewing their careers, and sadly, actually, in the UK, we were amongst the highest in terms of young people feeling extremely uncertain about the future. Now, one thing that I say is that the future of careers and work will be what many people describe as squiggly. That is, I think, a good construct to think about, which just means that the old constructs of, well, I've got to find my career and that's going to define the rest of my life, I think increasingly that's been dissipating for a bunch of other reasons, but we can certainly see as we look at the changing world of work going forwards that actually, and again, one can think about this very positively, that my career could take all sorts of directions. And there are hopefully lots of emergent opportunities that I can find my different talents and skills and interests, maybe at different stages of my life, and I can work more flexibly. And all these constructs that we've talked about for years, I think are very much now appearing as part of the world of work. What that says in terms of individuals, and to your question about so what do they need to focus on and what are the skills and capabilities, honestly, the first thing I always say, Michael, and I say it to leaders everywhere, and whenever I'm asked, what's the single thing you would say to leaders, I say is curiosity. It's being curious. If we are curious, it helps us to ask the questions. It helps us to challenge conventions or norms. It helps us to explore new ideas and things that we can benefit from. So I think being curious is absolutely critical. Linked to that is actually, I've used the word already, but anyway, critical thinking. So lots of businesses now, and I think it's true again of life and links to also the idea of curiosity, is to be able to not just take things at face value, to be able to question, to challenge. And this is coming up more and more. The more we see technology coming into the world of work, the more everybody's looking for this idea of, can you think critically? Can you look at the evidence that's presented and say, yeah, but what about this? Maybe I should go ask different questions. And of course, this has become a significant issue in a world where this debate about social media driving very particular thinking, because it keeps playing to, well, you like this, so here's more of it, versus encouraging us to challenge, is a really, really important element of this. So critical thinking, without a doubt, collaboration, our ability to work with others, communicate, they're all absolutely what are seen as, or variously described as, employability skills, essential skills, critical skills. And we've, part of the, we mentioned and talked a bit about good work. We've also done work, what a good job looks like. But we've also done work on what are these essential skills. And there's some good frameworks out there, one of which we work with particularly closely, which is called Skills Builder. But in essence, it's describing these sorts of skills. Learning is another one, you know, which links to the adaptability idea. So I see learning as a lifelong thing. And my goodness, in the world of technology now, what an opportunity to keep learning, which links back to curiosity. Anyway, so it is interesting to see it's these sorts of what I would regard, many regard, as the really human skills that have been called out more and more and more. And I think if young people are able to understand those and communicate those sorts of interests and skills, that is what will employers are looking for more and more. What we've got to make sure is that we are helping with a consistent language in the way in which we understand and assess those things.
That's fantastic advice. I don't know where to start with all that. I asked you for one and I ended up with half a dozen. That was fantastic. I'm going to pluck one out of the middle. Don't take things at face value. Oh my goodness, never has it been more important not to take things at face value. Fantastic. Peter Chase, thank you very, very much for joining us here on this episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast. It's been an absolute privilege. Thank you.
No, thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode of the NBS Business Leaders Podcast with Peter Cheese, why not try previous episodes with the new MD of Boots UK, Anthony Hermerdinger, the former Chief Exec of the Financial Ombudsman Service, Caroline Wyman, or the former head of the RAF, Air Chief Marshal Sir Andrew Pulford, KCB, CBE. This episode of the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast was produced by Russell Bingley and presented by Mike Sassy.